Welcome to Sense and Sensibility, the Inflation Guy podcast. It is the Inflation Guy. I am the Inflation Guy. I am Michael Ashton. I'm the Inflation Guy. I'm your host. And today on the podcast, I'm just going to clean up some inflation snippets that I've had around. You know, occasionally these little bits and pieces accumulate, none of which is enough for one podcast, but, you know, occasionally you have to clean up the detritus that accumulates. You know, I keep a document of things I want to talk about, and the good ideas and the big ideas kind of expand into podcasts, and then the little ideas kind of sit there waiting for something, and eventually you just have to sort of clean up that. And so that's what I'm going to do today. But first, a word from our sponsors. This episode of Sense and Sensibility is sponsored by Simplify ETFs, a fast-growing ETF shop democratizing access to the most sophisticated alternative strategies. With diversifying strategies like market-neutral equity long-short, managed futures, multi-strat quant, Simplify has a suite of compelling tools to help address the biggest concerns with the classic 60-40 portfolio. Check out their website at simplify.us, and you can find their entire lineup of ETFs at simplify.us/ETFs. And of course, this podcast is also sponsored by Enduring Investments. Inflation is looking like it's going to be sticky and not like it was before. This means that portfolio dynamics will be different going forward since the inflation factor is abroad in the land again. This affects you, whether you are an individual investor or a pension or insurance company or wealth management CIO. If you're looking for a manager for your personal money or a sub-advisor or a consultant for your corporate treasury or fund, look no further than Enduring to help you navigate these new portfolio dynamics. Defend your money. Visit us at enduringinvestments.com. So again, we're going to, I've just got a bunch of little notes here, and I'm hoping this doesn't seem disjointed. I've tried to put them in some sort of reasonable order, and there's something of a theme, I guess, to a lot of them. And I guess the theme is, the overarching theme is that, you know, over the last year or so, we've had, you know, these really kind of generous inflation dynamics. A lot of things kind of working, you know, used cars kind of going down after sort of, you know, blowing up the prior year, you know, housing starting to moderate. And so, you know, the story for the last year has been that that was really expected. We were going to see inflation coming down and that was going to continue into 2024. But the real question, the question for a long time has been, how far does that go? And so I think one of the themes to today's snippet pile is that, you know, we're starting to see that some of those things are running out of gas, as it were. And maybe the dynamic going forward, and I've said before, 2024 was going to be harder than 2023 in this regard, but we're starting to sort of see, you know, some of these stories turning, including some places that I hadn't really expected to see them. Before we get to sort of U.S. inflation, you know, obviously inflation is a global phenomenon. And actually, this is actually not in my list, but I thought I would throw it in because I'm just thinking about it right now. Inflation is sort of a global phenomenon. And there's a lot of, one of the things that we know is that among connected countries, economically connected countries, and so that's, you know, the G10 especially, but then lots of other of the satellite quasi-connected nations, you know, there's a to some extent a shared inflation process. And a couple of guys years ago back at the World Bank wrote a paper sort of establishing that, I don't remember the exact numbers, but something like 2/3 of the inflation in any given country is sort of sourced from this global inflation factor. And you can sort of, in a non-quantitative term, what that sort of means is that inflation the world over, country to country, doesn't go, you know, one direction in country A and a totally different direction in country B. It's not random from country to country. There's some correlation. They kind of do tend to all move together. And again, these fellows found that about 2/3 of inflation in any given country, in the connected countries, is sourced from sort of global global sources. And that makes sort of sense. You know that the money that the Fed adds to the U.S. economy is fungible. It adds to liquidity everywhere. And so you would expect that there's a lot of coincidence of inflation. We actually used this at Enduring Investments to design a strategy and a way of looking at global inflation-linked bonds, stripping out kind of the common component. But again, that's not my topic today. My point is that I'm going to mostly talk about U.S. inflation today. But there's one story that is, I think, worth looking at in Japan. Japan obviously has been in or near deflation for a long period of time, and long enough that it really confused a lot of people who thought that that was due to the demographics, the fact that Japan is one of the oldest countries in terms of the average age of the population in the world, and in correlation, you know, was taken to mean causation, when of course the real reason that Japan has been in very low inflation for a very long period of time is that the money supply in Japan hasn't grown anything like it has in all the other connected countries, the rest of the G7 or G10 or whatever. And that's the main reason that Japan had low inflation. But, starting a few years ago, the Bank of Japan started to try more aggressively to add liquidity. For a while, they went to negative interest rates. They've now gone back to zero interest rates. But as you know, since you listen to this podcast, it's not the interest rates we want to look at. And so for a while, Japan was actively working to add to the money supply. And then they kind of decided they just wanted to focus on zero and on negative interest rates. But in the last year, an interesting development has been that not only did prices start to look like they were headed higher, but the Ministry of Finance and the Bank of Japan started engaging in this jawboning of calling around and trying to persuade everybody that it's patriotic to raise prices, and that it's patriotic to want to pay higher prices, that inflation would be good for Japan, and so we should all band together and do that. And I highlighted this, I think, in my quarterly, probably 6 or 9 months ago, because it's really bizarre for a government to tell its people that inflation is really, really good for you and we should really want it. And it was kind of curious to see whether or not that works out. Well, so I'm mentioning this because we just had the Shunto wage negotiations that it's a major wage settlement in Japan, big group of workers. And it's essentially a big auto union, I guess. And and Toyota, the biggest manufacturer of autos in Japan, basically accepted the union's demand for a wage increase. And the average wage increase this year will be 5.28%, which is the largest increase in many, many, many years, decades. And apparently, Toyota didn't even counter these demands. Now, remember, in the U.S., 5.28% compared to what the UAW, the auto workers unions in the U.S. asked for last year, that if their demands had been fully accepted, would have basically doubled the wage. and they ended up agreeing to much, 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 much less, but still, a fairly appreciable wage increase. But the fact that, the union could propose a 5% wage increase and the company says, yeah, that's fine, it tells you something. It tells you that there is some pressure to accept from the corporate side of things, to accept these higher prices and to just pass them through. So anyway, I that's sort of a fascinating development. And by the way, it's this is something that I was going to plan to talk about in a couple of weeks anyway. Normally, and I've said this before, but normally wages follow prices. The whole notion of cost push inflation where, you know, wages go up and then prices go up, it makes no sense. That we would love that to be the case, but it generally is not the case. Wages and prices are integrated in such a way that one adds momentum to the other, but it's very rare for wages to precede inflation. This is an example where, granted, inflation had already been ticking up in Japan up to the 2%-ish range, but this is the first example I can remember seeing where it really does kind of look like the wages, you know, are coming first. I mean, you know, asking for 5% when inflation is 2% is interesting. We'll see how that passes through, but it's worth calling out because it is an unusual twist of fate for Japan. Okay, so that's one little snippet, but the other snippets maybe will be a little faster. So, where to start? Okay, so here's one. Median wages in the U.S., since we were just talking about wages, are still rising at 5%. So the Atlanta Fed wage growth tracker had been much higher, but it's come down to only 5% year on year. And that's lower than it was in 2022, 2023, any point during the year. But otherwise, it's still the highest since 2001. And what's been interesting is that as this has ebbed, as it's come down, and again, I like the wage growth tracker. It's better than the average hourly earnings because compositionally, it's sort of smarter. And looking at a median instead of an average is a nice, steady way to do it. It's come down, but it really hasn't crashed as everybody sort of thought it would. Once inflation starts coming down, all of a sudden, then you can't get any more wage increases, and so wage inflation dies. And the other thing that I've been pointing out is that as long as wages continue to rise at that kind of pace, it's really hard to get core services, ex rents, which is also known as super core these days, I guess. It's hard to get that piece to go down and be well-behaved if wages are going up at 5%. So that's something that's sort of worth looking at, or worth keeping an eye on. Now let's turn to housing for another snippet. So the Biden administration recently proposed I guess I've lost track of whether this is just an administrative diktat or whether this is a proposed legislation, but they proposed a big first-time home buyer credit with the idea that because interest rates are so much higher than they were 2 years ago, I mean, they were too low 2 years ago, but man, I don't know if they're too high now, but they were too low, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, but because they're so much higher now, the Biden administration says that this is freezing out first-time home buyers. It's freezing out everybody, to be honest, but it's freezing out first-time home buyers. And so, you know, they're proposing a big tax credit for a first-time home buyer to help defray the costs of, you know, the high cost of the mortgage. So I have a couple of predictions. One will be that home buyer tax credit will outlast higher rates. Higher rates will come down at some point, and the tax credit will remain there because that's kind of true of, you know, most of the tax code is that we tend to get, you know, all of the spending tends to stick around, and credits and giveaways tend to stick around, and that's why we kind of run perpetual deficits. But the other thing I will point out is that if in fact this is going to become policy, then what it does is it delays those buyers from buying until the law is passed or until it becomes policy. If you're a first-time home buyer and you're thinking about buying a home right now, you should wait because if you do it now, then you don't get the credit. And so you really should wait. And so, you know, proposing something like this tends to slow down activity in the housing market, not speed it up until it actually becomes policy, it becomes law. Obviously, once it does become law, then it'll push prices and volumes higher in the housing market because you've just made it cheaper for a whole bunch of buyers. They're going to go and they're going to be able to bid higher. And in fact, first-time home buyers will be able to outbid existing homeowners who are rolling to a new home because they have a tax credit. The existing, you know, the older folks don't. So anyway, it's obviously an inflationary thing, but it also in the short term will slow down activity in the housing market, which has been sort of slowly recovering. Speaking of activity in the housing market, existing home sales median price, the existing home sales report was out this week, and the median price is now up 5.7% year on year. Turnover is still low. The existing home sales themselves are pretty low, even though they were much higher than consensus expectations. But the median price being up 5.7% year on year was a big surprise. At some point, as people get adjusted to the new interest rates, the higher interest rates, and recognize that the old interest rates aren't coming back, you're not going to be able to finance a home at 3% for a long, 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 long time, if ever, then volumes in new home sales, existing home sales, will continue to come back. And now I'm not so interested about the volumes as I am about the prices, and the prices going up 5.7% year on year just reminds us again that all the people who were telling you that there was going to be a deflationary debacle in the housing market, I never knew what they were talking about. It's very hard to have a deflationary debacle in the housing market if the underlying pace of inflation is 5 or 6 or 7%. Because if housing prices just go flat, then you're having this real decline in prices that's substantial. So, you know, what happened in 2008, 9, and 10 was that we were already at really low levels of inflation. And so when you had a huge surplus of houses and you had a bubble burst, then you did have big nominal declines in houses because that's the only way you could get the real price of a house lower because we were already at very low levels of inflation. But when you're at a higher level of inflation and you just go sideways on a home price, it's becoming cheaper by a meaningful amount. And that's what happened. We kind of went sideways for a little bit and now home prices are reaccelerating. It looks like rents are going to continue to decelerate into the third quarter, as I've been saying they would. But my forecast for a long time has been that rents would bottom in the low threes, maybe in the high twos. And that's always been way on the high side of consensus. For a while, the consensus was that rents would go negative. If anything is looking like my forecast might not be high enough. Okay, going from housing, which is the slowest moving of the inflation pieces, to the fastest moving one, gasoline is now 50 cents higher than it was in January. It's still not as high as it was last fall, but thinking back to last fall, we had declines in gasoline prices October, November, and December that flattered the headline inflation in November, December, and January. And that's one of the reasons, you remember there was this kind of not so subtle shift to kind of look at the fact that the headline inflation rate was starting to get close to the Fed's target. Well, the reason the headline inflation rate was getting close to the Fed's target was because gasoline was dragging it down. And that's no longer going to be the case. Over the next few months, we're going to, last month and over the next couple of months, you're going to start to see the gasoline is adding again, to headline inflation. Although it's not as much as it looks like when you just see gasoline prices up 50 cents, because obviously the number you see from inflation, the monthly number, is seasonally adjusted. And seasonally, we expect gasoline prices to go up this time of year a little bit. And so you won't get quite the impact as it looks like you'll get because you have the seasonal adjustment that's pushing it lower. But still, the point is it's now a following wind going the other direction. Similarly, and by the way, that's the theme of a lot of things that we're seeing here. Used car prices, they're rising again. And now some of this, again, is the seasonal tendency that used car prices tend to rise in the first half of the year a little bit. But that hasn't happened for the last couple of years because, you know, we had this big run-up. That was, consistent with the rise in the money supply. But we had a decline in used car prices. Used car prices are a major component of core goods. And so this core goods component was decelerating quite a bit, quite a bit of that coming from used cars. Well, used car prices are starting to rise again. It looks like the lows from used car prices are probably in. Again, that's going to make this going forward, it's going to make core goods, it's going to make it harder to keep it at zero or this low level of deflation that we have. Airfares. I mentioned this actually in my blog. Recently, it has confused me because airfare prices in the CPI have been higher than what you would have anticipated if you just looked at what's happening to jet fuel prices. And that's the main source of volatility in airfares is jet fuel prices. But recently, the airfares have been a little bit more buoyant than jet fuel prices have been. Well, belatedly, I think I now have some idea of what's going on. And there were some articles over the last couple of weeks, I'll call out Bloomberg had a nice one, pointing out that Boeing, because of the problems with its MAX line of jets, the MAX 10 and the MAX 8 and the MAX 9, whatever, the problems that they had have greatly slowed deliveries because they got to figure out what the heck the problem is and solve the problem and all their corrections and changes have to go get, re-examined, reauthorized by the FAA or whatever. And so that's really, really slowed deliveries. And so Southwest Airlines came out and said that they're cutting capacity and freezing hiring because they're not getting the planes that they need from Boeing. And they're not alone. Every major carrier that uses Boeing planes is having a capacity constraint. And this is not necessarily like the capacity constraint we had in during COVID, with lines of ships pulling up at the ports where all you had to do is wait and eventually those lines of ships would that those delays would eventually be removed. Delivering planes takes a long time. And so if you really do have this kind of ripple that holds up for some period of time, airplane deliveries, then the impact on airfares could last for a while. Anyway, that's something that we have to keep in mind and factor into our forecast as we go forward that, this potential supply constraint in airfares or in airline capacity, which, therefore tends to cause any given amount of demand causes the price to be higher. It's clearly a transitory effect in some sense, but again, it takes a long time to build a plane, so that transitory can be quite long. So let's just go through what we've said here. We've got housing that's rolling higher. We've got energy that's rolling higher. We have wages that aren't crashing. We have used cars starting to rise. We have airfares that are starting to rise. You put all these things together, and now there are things that are going down, of course. We can't just look at the things that are going up. But, the idiosyncrasies here, the idiosyncratic stories do seem to be, the anecdotal stories do seem to be on the side of things going up when we didn't expect them to be going up because we've sort of been in the camp where everything should be decelerating a little bit, right? So if all those things are happening, then it's going to get to be hard to see inflation outside of the ongoing lagged effect from housing. Rents will continue to decelerate for a little bit. It's going to get hard to see inflation get to the levels necessary for the Fed to declare victory. they still might declare victory anyway. but this Fed, more and more, it looks like to get meaningful Fed easing, you're going to need an accident, and there's no accident currently scheduled. The FOMC minutes, the minutes from the Fed meeting that were just released this week, the Fed raised, well, the collective forecasts of the members of the committee were called for a somewhat higher, like 25 basis points higher, long-term nominal interest rate, which is a fairly large move in what the Fed policymakers see as sort of the long-run equilibrium rate. I think it's still too low for my view, but it's a recognition that having a deeply negative real Fed funds rate, as was the policy for the most part under Bernanke in the Yellen terms, that was a mistake. And I think the Fed recognizes, and maybe not everyone at the Fed, but I do think that Powell recognizes that that was a mistake that they're going to try hard not to repeat, again, unless there's an accident and none is currently scheduled. So I think that's significant. There is one – now, all the things I mentioned today should be bearish for stocks. this is all – this is bad news. I mean, inflation staying too high and the Fed not, you know, easing as much as people were expecting or wanting should be bad for equities. But what we're seeing these days is that every story is being spun to being bullish for equities. And that concerns me because the only other time I've ever seen that was in 1999. And, you know, there, if in fact you thought that having those great low interest rates were was bullish for stocks, which is what we were told for years, then to be consistent, you've got to think that higher interest rates is bearish for stocks. And yet somehow we're being told that higher interest rates are not, because they're not as high as they could otherwise be, or something. Every story we get is somehow bullish, and those stories are the dominant stories. They're not just like, you know, some quack, you know, spouting something bullish about Tesla. It's you're actually getting sort of the mainstream response to be bullish to everything, and that is not sustainable in the long run. As we saw in 99, it can go a long time, but it's a concerning thing. Okay, well, I have another snippet or two, but I think that's enough snippets for today. We're already up at 28 minutes or so, and I really do try to keep these things from getting too long, because listening to me drone on for much more than half an hour is probably not fair to anybody. So I think we're going to stop it there. And we'll pick up. I'm actually going to take a week off, I think, because I'm showing my my daughter some colleges. So we won't have a podcast next week, but we'll have one the week following. So take a week off. And thank you for tuning in. That's all for today's podcast. As always, I really appreciate it when you do refer other people to this podcast and when you subscribe to it. If you have any questions, contact or ideas for things you'd like to hear, write to me at inflationguy@enduringinvestments.com. Again, my blog at inflationguy.blog is free. Visit Enduring Investments if you have an inflation challenge. And most importantly, defend your money. Defend your money! And if inflation is coming for you, remember, you know a guy.